Okay, good evening, everybody. Our topic for tonight will be Jews in the American Revolutionary War. But before we get to the war itself, I want to just finish up some points from last time about Jews in colonial America. Jews were trying to fit in, and that meant not wearing distinctive garb, so you couldn't tell on the street a Jew from a Gentile. It's interesting that if you compare Gershom Mendesatius, who was the Chazan, the minister at Sherith Israel in New York, to a Protestant minister, he would look just like a Protestant minister. There was nothing distinguishing about him that was Jewish. Later on, in certain Western countries, the Jewish clergy would wear a big Magen David, but otherwise have Protestant clerical attire, but the Magen David would stick out. In the case of Mendesatius, nothing stood out. You'd have to know he was a Jew to be aware. And you could make a sharp contrast between what Satius looked like and what Rabbi Chaim Yitzchak Karigal looked like. If you remember from last time, Karigal was a rabbi from Eretz Yisrael who came as an itinerant scholar slash schnurrer to the New World and was collecting funds for the yeshivot of Eretz Yisrael, but he dressed like a Middle Eastern cleric. So he looked distinctive compared to those who were in the New World. Okay. Can everybody hear me? I see someone says they can't hear me. Can everyone hear?
Yes, can hear fine.
Good. All right. So despite high levels of acculturation, many Jews tried to keep scrupulously kosher and were disappointed when other members of their family failed to do so. So during the colonial period, there was some dissension within family over religious laxity versus religious piety. What about synagogue architecture? So the Newport Synagogue, Yeshuat Yisrael, tried to synthesize Jewish tradition and contemporary culture. The architecture of the building had a Palladian balance, which was popular in the colonies in the 18th century. But it was undone, this balance was undone by the construction of the wing of the building for the Talmud Torah, for the Cheder, for the Hebrew school. You couldn't see the Talmud Torah from the street level, so the architectural balance was preserved for those looking at it, but from the side or from behind, it was a little bit off. And why? For the sake of teaching the children. However, on the inside of the building, the concern was not for 18th century Protestant architecture, but rather to mimic the London Sephardic synagogue. And so the inside of the Toro synagogue looks like a traditional Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Okay. The younger generation that was born in the United States was less religious than the parental generation. Not always, interestingly, but most of the time. In some cases, the parental generation were traditional Jews from the European continent or from the Caribbean who then came to America and tried to preserve their religious rituals but didn't indoctrinate their children so heavily and didn't give them the kind of Hebraic or Judaic education that would result in strong religious observance down the line, the Dor Vador. And so it declined. In other instances, however, these were people who themselves were crypto-Jews or new Christians who had to first emerge as Jews themselves upon arriving in the New World from Catholic countries. And they tried to convey religious sentiment to their children, but not always all that effectively. So the younger generation did not understand the Siddur and would have benefited from a suitable translation. The problem is, who's going to write that translation? It would not be until the 1840s in the works of Isaac Leiser when you'd have an American Jew who was Judaically learned enough and proficient enough in English to produce the kind of English language Jewish volumes for synagogue use that really would help people preserve their religious heritage. Okay. There were some conversions to Judaism for matrimonial purpose, but not very many. After the revolution, we'll see that would happen in significantly greater numbers. Outright assimilation and exogamy, intermarriage, happened even among the families of communal leaders. So no family, even the most prestigious American Jewish families of the colonial period, were immune to out-and-out assimilation and intermarriage. Okay. While there was some anti-Semitism in colonial America, stemming from the religious and economic prejudices back in England, The colonies were generally tolerant and devoid of anti-Jewish outbursts. In other words, violence against Jews was almost unheard of. Jews were not the only quote-unquote other in the colonies. It was a multi-ethnic and multi-religious society. Now, granted, Jews were the only significant non-Christian denomination, but there were so many different Christian denominations at loggerheads with each other that Jews did not stick out all that much, and people were of widely varying racial and ethnic backgrounds. So it's a hodgepodge society, and Jews are not the only hated other. They're just one of many. Okay. Now we get to the Revolutionary War. Jews were on the political sidelines in the colonial period. After all, although they had economic rights and the right of religious worship, they, for the most part, did not have the right to vote in elections or to hold public office, at least not in, in almost all the states or all the colonies. This would change with the Revolutionary War. Jews would no longer be on the sidelines, but rather for the first time they would take a stand, sometimes a very vocal stand, on a political issue of relevance to the society around them, whether to be loyalists to the crown, to George III, or to be patriots, Whigs, Continentals, rebels. Okay, Moshe is asking, where are most Jews immigrating from? So by the 1760s and 1770s, most Jews are immigrating from the Ashkenazic world, from Germany and Poland. Especially the partition of Poland in 1772 led to some trickle out of the country. There were not that many crypto-Jews or new Christians emerging from Catholic countries anymore by the mid to late 1700s. That had run its course 54 through the early, through maybe the 1730s. So yes, there are some Sephardic Jews coming from the Caribbean, but mostly Ashkenazic Jews, either from the Caribbean or from continental Europe. Okay, so Jews are taking sides in the war. And the irony is actually that they didn't have to. They didn't have to take sides, but they did it anyway. What do I mean by they didn't have to take sides? Well, John Adams, second president of the United States of America, famously described the situation in terms of political loyalties at the outbreak of the war as a third of the colonists were patriots, meaning supporting independence. A third were loyalists, meaning supporting British crown rule. And a third sat on the fence, yoshev al shnei ha'sipim, as we would say in the biblical terminology. They're seeing how the way the wind blows, you know, see which way the wind blows, and that's what they will support. They're sitting on the fence. So it was okay to sit on the fence. You didn't have to vocally assert a strong political viewpoint one way or the other. And yet most Jews chose not to remain neutral. Nearly all picked a side, and sometimes quite visibly. Why? So why not sit this one out? The answer is that by showing that they had a political viewpoint, it meant that they truly belonged in America, whatever its political future. And they don't know what that political future is going to be, but they're going to take a stand because they want to be active participants. And this is an opportunity for the first time to be an active participant. To sit on the side, to sit on the fence, would be just a repeat of medieval and pre-modern times where the Jews don't have a political say in anything, and whoever runs the country will treat them as a corporate body. So that's what the Jews don't want anymore. They want to have a say in the matter, so they'll take a stand. It was a milestone in the emergence of the modern Jew as a citizen participating in civic life. And this doesn't begin in 1776. It actually begins as early as 1765 with Jewish merchants opposing the Stamp Act, and in 1770 with Jewish merchants opposing the Tea Act, and some Jews participating not in the Boston Tea Party directly, because there really weren't that many Jews in Boston, but opposition to the collection of taxes on tea and in not remitting those taxes to the British authorities. So already from the 1760s, Jews, some Jews at least, are showing
I'm out of the kitchen.
What?
Jonathan, I'm out.
Oh, you gotta be. So, because Jews were not persecuted in colonial America, their choice of side, whether patriot or loyalist, would be determined by national, business, and personal considerations, meaning it was not going to be determined by Jewish considerations. It's not as though one side was seen as anti-Semitic and horrible, and the other side as the other side as philo-Semitic and, you know, messianic and the Mashiach. No. People were going to make their determination on the basis of what helped their business interests, what was good for them personally, or if they truly had sincere nationalist sentiment that they thought the country as a whole, not just the Jews, would be better served under this regime or that regime. Okay. So some Jews delayed picking a side as long as they could, but once it became apparent that it would behoove them to choose sides, they did, and did so assertively. Okay. The vast majority of America, of colonial Jews supported the Whig side, the Patriot side, the rebellious independent side, and not the crown. But a significant minority did support the British crown, and we'll have to address why that was so, and some famous people and what happened to them as a result of being on the losing team in the long run. Okay. 100 Jewish soldiers fought in the Continental Army, and including some who died. Francis Salvador, who I mentioned last week as being the first Jew elected to public office in the United States in 1774 in South Carolina, died a grisly death on the battlefield after having been scalped by Tory allied Indians. Actually, he didn't die immediately from being scalped. He lived another about 45 minutes, they say, and handed off his weapon and his tchotchkes to his fellow soldier and said, "I'm going to lie down and die." And that was the end of him, Francis Salvador. But others also paid the ultimate price and gave their lives in the cause of the revolution. So the most important thing that we should learn about in the revolutionary period is the dislocation of Jews and Jewish communities. So Jews left cities occupied by the British as a sign of loyalty to the American cause. Now, in truth, we should say, this was not just a Jewish thing. This was a general thing. The Goyim did it too. That if you were a patriot and your city was occupied by British forces, the tradition was you left. You didn't just sit there and become a captive audience to the enemy, but rather you moved over 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, or to a nearby city and tried to live your life under the regime of your choice. And so New York Jews tended to be in favor of independence. They tended to be patriots, despite the fact that New York was a Tory-dominated city. Most of the Gentiles in New York were actually loyalists. And so Sheriff Israel was bucking the trend in New York by supporting Washington and the revolutionary cause. This was already apparent in May of 1776, 2 months before the Declaration of Independence was signed, that Sheriff Israel, on a certain Shabbos in May of 1776, said the following prayer from the pulpit, led by Satius. Quote, "O Lord, the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, may it please thee to put into the heart of our sovereign, Lord George III, and the heart of his counselors, princes, and servants, to turn their fierce wrath away from North America, and to destroy the wicked devices of our enemies, that it may fall on their own heads." The last line reminds me of the Al Hanisim prayer on Purim, where we say at the end, "Vahash v'kil kaltat machashavto bashevota log mulo burosho." You turn it on its head. That the Haman tried to kill the Jews, and instead he got his comeuppance, and he was hung. George III is out to get us, so let him and his counselors and his princes suffer the fate that they want to impose upon us. But already in May, before there's independence, they daven, "God, please take the British wrath and turn it away from us, because they're being bad to us." Okay. Now, Geshem and Desatius decided to leave town. So where did he go? Well, he took the Sifrei Torah, some of the Sifrei Torah from Sherith Israel, and many of the congregants. And when the British took over the city in the late summer of 1776, they fled to Connecticut. So they went across Harlem, through Washington Heights, across Westchester, probably through New Rochelle or Scarsdale, and eventually made it to Stratford, Connecticut, where they stayed there for 4 years. In 1780, they moved to Philadelphia, where they stayed for another 2 years, at a time when almost half the Jews were in Philadelphia because it was a refuge for all the various communities that had been captured by the British. So Satius goes to Stratford, Connecticut, then he goes to Philadelphia. Did anybody stay behind in New York? The answer is yes. There were loyalist Jews. There were who stayed behind, and they had two Sifrei Torah, and they kept the shul going. They were helped out by a German Jew, a Hessian mercenary. Now remember, the British hired German mercenaries, the Hessians, to fight for them, because George III really was a German himself. He wasn't really British. And some of those Hessian mercenaries were Jews. One of them was named Alexander Zuns, and he was a shtickel chazen at Baal Tzvila. And while the Patriots were out of New York and Sherith Israel was basically abandoned, so the Hessian mercenaries davened for the Yamud, and Alexander Zuns led the shul. So it's a very bizarre twist that the enemy was leading the davening in the shul. Okay. Other communities also suffered terribly from a British takeover. So Savannah fell in 1778, and Charleston fell in 1780. So a lot of these Jews didn't know where to go. They ended up, a lot of them, in Philadelphia. Philadelphia itself was taken over briefly by the British, and then many of the Jews moved inland to York and Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There's a question on the chat. Does Sherith Israel sit for the tefillah for the government to this day because of their support for the colonists? I don't know. We'll have to ask Mayor Soloveitchik what the policy is on the prayer for the government. Okay. So who was among the Jewish clergy in favor of British rule? The answer is Isaac Turo. Isaac Turo was the chazan in Newport, in Yeshuat Yisrael, Turo's synagogue. And when the Americans retook Newport, he had to get out of Dodge. So he fled to New York, which was still under British rule, and davened the Sherith Israel for a little while. But when the war was over and the British were ousted, and he had been known for being a loyalist, he couldn't in good conscience stay in the United States of America. So where did he go? He fled to British Jamaica and lived out the rest of his life as a chazan, davening for the Yamud in Jamaica. Okay. Well, the majority of Jews, as I said, supported independence, and only a minority favored the crown. This belies a popular historical notion that minority groups that feared for their status in a newly independent America tended to side with the British on the thinking that the known status quo was better than the unknown future. So that's what historians tended to think, but in the case of the Jews and the Catholics, it turns out that that's not true. So let's understand this for a second. The logic might have dictated that if life is decent enough under British rule, but you don't know as a religious minority or an ethnic minority what will happen under a revolutionary regime, so it might be the prudent thing not to support a revolutionary regime, but rather stick with what you know. But as it turned out, that wasn't the case in the situation of the Jews. So let's ask a question. Why was that not the case? Why did the Jews not prefer the known arrangement, which was pretty good under the British, and why go the riskier route of independence, when who's to say that Philo-Semitic as opposed to anti-Semitic folks will run the new regime? Any suggestions? Anyone have an idea?
Yeah.
Pressure.
It might impact on the recently recent invitation to return to England after an exile from the British Isles under Oliver. So I don't know. In other words, the impact would have been tremendous on the Jewish population negatively in the British Isles.
So what you're suggesting is if Jews were known to be Whigs or patriots or pro-independence in America, and the British authorities were aware of that fact, it might have reflected badly on the state of Jewish civil rights back in England.
But
akin to the situation in the 1930s with, you know, American Jewish boycott of Germany reflecting, you know, resulting in damage to the German Jewish community in Germany, or for that matter, the rise of the state of Israel resulting in the persecution of Jews in Arab lands. So you're right, that sort of thing could be in play. But I think the main reason why it turned out not to be a factor
is most people, all their neighbors, and they were merchants, going the way against the Tories. They'd be in the far greater minority.
Okay, so you're right that at the local level, to be a Tory in an area where the majority were Whig would get you personally in a whole heap of trouble, much more trouble than what the government could impose upon you. But rather, your neighbors would think you're a traitor or a bad apple. As it turned out, that actually happened to a certain Jew. Isaac was a New York Jew and was a loyalist shipper who was involved in international trade. And when the colonialists took over, he fled to Long Island, but he didn't flee far enough. And he was executed point-blank range by patriotic Whigs. So an example where if you're a Tory, but among Whigs, you could get into big trouble and bad things could happen. You could lose your life. Okay. But the other factor, I think, is that people sincerely believed that the colonists and the leading figures among the colonists were not likely to backtrack on Jewish rights. Progress might be slow in coming. As it turned out, it happened pretty quickly. But even if it was slow in coming, there wouldn't be any backsliding under an American regime as opposed to a British regime. Therefore, there wasn't much risk. It wasn't a gamble to be a Whig. It was a gamble, actually, to be a Tory. Okay. Now, let's talk about some people who played a significant role in the war. So, Mordechai Schefftel from Savannah was a very prominent Savannah family, the Schefftel family. He was the head of the local revolutionary committee. And in 1778, he was offered the commission as deputy commissary of general for federal troops. So this is some fairly top-level position in the civilian administration of the military. He was captured by the British and sent to the British ship Nancy, where he was tortured, and then he escaped, and then he was captured again, and he escaped again. So, but he was a great patriot. Mordechai Schefftel appointed to a high-level position. Another important story from the war was that of Gershom Mendesatius, the Chazan of Sherith Israel, who I said ran away. He came back to New York because Samuel Lazarus of the New York Jewish community, one of his parishioners, wanted to get married and needed a clergyman to officiate the wedding. Yeah, you have to have a rabbi for the wedding, you know. So he snuck back into New York and officiated the wedding and didn't get caught. And then he went back to Connecticut. As it turned out, Samuel Lazarus was the grandfather of Emma Lazarus, the poet who wrote the poem that appears on the Statue of Liberty. Okay, what about Chaim Salomon? So Chaim Salomon is by far the most famous Jew from the revolutionary period. And we need to know why he is famous. Is it exaggerated what his role was? Let's find out. So Salomon was hailed by ethno-pietists in the 1890s as the great financier of the revolution because of his work between 1781 and 1784 in marketing U.S. notes in Philadelphia for the Office of Finance. He also sold Dutch and French bills of exchange, which underwrote the loans for the United States. His efforts as a broker were exaggerated by later admirers. Now, who were these later admirers? The answer is that in 1892, the American Jewish Historical Society was established. At around that time, a lot of alphabet soup Jewish organizations were being established by the rich German Jewish leadership. The Jewish Publication Society was established in 1888. American Jewish Historical Society, 1892. And the goal was not academic scholarship like it is today. There was no academic scholarship back then. The goal was to produce literature for the lay people, and not just for the Jews, but for the Goyim too. And this literature would prove that ever since the beginning, Jews have been patriotic Americans. So the American Jewish Historical Society, its goal is not just to remember the past for the past's sake. You know, sometimes people don't really care about history. My dahava hava, what was. We care about history for its relevance in the here and now. And if we can point to the past as proof that we were great patriot Americans, then they'll treat us better in the here and now. Okay, so that was the goal of the founders of AJHS. And what they did was to comb the records of the colonial period and the revolutionary period and the early Republican period to try to find Jewish contribution to American society. And they found in Chaim Salomon a great hero. And they above and beyond exaggerated his role. Not that his role was insignificant, but he was put on a pedestal as the chief hero of all time. Okay, so let's learn a little bit about him without the exaggeration. What was his actual life story? Okay, so the story of Chaim Salomon is as follows. He was born in Lisa, in Poland, in 1740, to a Sephardic family. Now, wait a second. There are Sephardim in Poland? Who ever heard of such a thing of Sephardim in Poland? The answer is yes, there were Sephardim in Poland, especially in southern Poland. And these were people who had migrated from the 1490s up until the early 1700s across Europe as, you know, refugees from the Spanish expulsion and Inquisition. So he was from a Sephardic family. He left Poland at an early age, and he traveled around Europe learning various European languages, which would serve him in good stead, and learning the profession of finance. He briefly went back to Poland in 1770, but left in 1772 upon the first partition of Poland. As I mentioned before, a few moments ago, that around that time was the first partition of Poland. The second partition would be in 1793. The third partition would be in 1795, and Poland would cease to exist. It would be gobbled up by Austria, Russia, and Prussia. But when it was gobbled up, Jews sometimes felt uncomfortable and would leave to the New World. So he left for London, and then in 1775 came to the United States. He came to New York and served as a broker for maritime merchants. He joined the cause of the American Patriots and became a member of the Sons of Liberty, was a prominent member of the New York Sons of Liberty. He was arrested for espionage and was forced to work on a boat as a translator for the Hessian mercenaries, because after all, he spoke German. He was pardoned, but then was arrested again and sentenced to death. He was sentenced to death. He escaped and ran away to Philadelphia. He became an agent to the French consul and the paymaster to all French troops in North America. Now remember, the French were supportive of the American Revolution because their enemy was the British, and there were French troops fighting in North America, and he made sure that they got their Parnassa. He was the functionary paying them out. He also worked, and this is his most famous contribution, he worked for Robert Morris. Who was Robert Morris? Morris was the U.S. Superintendent of Finance, essentially the head of the Treasury Department before there was a Treasury Department. And from 1781 to 84, Salomon either raised or personally lent up to $650,000 to George Washington's army. His most important contribution was in the Battle of Yorktown. The Battle of Yorktown begins with Washington's forces nowhere near Yorktown. They're stuck in the Hudson Valley, 200 miles away, more, 300 miles away. And they have to travel southbound, but they have to have provisions, and it's going to cost money. It's going to cost $20,000 to bring the troops from the Hudson Valley area down to the Chesapeake area to fight the Battle of Yorktown. And the Union, Patriot Army, the Continental Army, was tapped out of funds. The government, under the Articles of Confederation, was out of money. There was nothing. So Washington supposedly said, find Chaim Salomon and he'll give us the money. And lo and behold, Salomon was able to come up with the money, okay, when nobody else could. Okay, so Salomon was the founder of Mikveh Israel, which was the synagogue in Philadelphia. And he gave the largest single donation when the shul was dedicated in 1782. However, just a few years later, he died penniless in January of 1785. Why was he penniless? Because the U.S. government did not pay back its debts, or at least not in full. They paid back pennies on the dollar. This was also one of the reasons for the French Revolution, because the French held a lot of U.S. debt, and the U.S. didn't pay it back. So that led to political uncertainty across the sea. Chaim Salomon was also noted for being a Freemason. Why is it relevant that he was a Freemason? And what is the role of Freemasonry in colonial America and its relationship to the Jews? Does anybody have any idea?
Well, I know that I think Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and a bunch of other founding fathers were Freemasons also.
Okay, that's...
Sworn Mason, I can tell you that it was a kind of fraternity of primarily Jews, but it's open to everybody, of course, who believe in God, by way of staying together and confronting the social ills of society.
Okay, good. So Freemasonry.
Freemasonry, yeah.
Freemasonry is an opportunity for Jews to engage with Gentiles in a semi-neutral or actually neutral society. That in pre-modern Europe, there was no neutral space for Jews and Christians to mingle. But rather, the Jew was the other and was a social outcast. In the New World, things were less rigid. And Freemasonry was quite popular because it was an alternative to doctrinaire Christianity. You just had to be a believer in something. Even if it was deism or Unitarianism, it was kosher enough. And Jews as well, as believers in some higher power, but lav dafka, not necessarily a specific higher power. So the fact that Chaim Salomon was a Freemason should not surprise us, because this was a way for Jews to meet and greet new people who were not their religious kinsmen or their co-religionists, but were like-minded and tolerant and open towards social intercourse with the.
It's important to note that this is predates professional associations and labor unions,
correct,
and even B'nai B'rith, which began in
1843. Yeah.
So all of that is part of it.
It's true. So. So we've discussed Chaim Salomon. Let's examine what Jews thought about the war as it was ongoing and what they did, especially those who didn't fight. So Jews did many odd jobs for the revolution. Aside from soldiering, they functioned as suppliers, as bill brokers, as money lenders, shopkeepers, blockade runners, and even small-scale manufacturers. The Jews of Saint Eustatius, in the Caribbean, supported the revolution by smuggling supplies. And in 1781, they were punished for their support for the revolution by being expelled from the island by the British. So several hundred Jews were expelled from their Caribbean island because of their pro-colonist approach. Now, believing Christians saw in George III a pharaoh, he's Paro Melech Mitzrayim, and that the Americans are the B'nai Yisrael, are the true Israelites. So if you're a believing Christian, if your frame of reference is always the Bible, there's Mitzrayim and Paro and B'nai Yisrael, and the British are the bad guys and we're the good guys. For American Jews, the biblical imagery was there, although it was not as dramatic. They were not obsessing over it. But they did see in the events happening around them marker of biblical themes, such as destruction, exile, and redemption. Okay? Now, going into exile away from your home, meaning for the Jews of New York who go to Connecticut or to Philadelphia, the Jews of Savannah or Charleston who go to Philadelphia, going into exile connotes something very interesting. It connotes that your earlier home really was your home, that you're no longer the wandering Jew. You're wandering now as an American. You're the wandering American who's in exile for your politics. You're not the wandering Jew, but rather your prior home really was a home. and could become a permanent one when the war ends and the dust settles and peace breaks out. So this is an interesting psychological twist, that you're not the wandering Jew, you're the wandering American. Okay. Jews were present at all the major battles. The Jews were present at Valley Forge. They were even present at Bunker Hill. Not in any large appreciable numbers, but there was at least a Jew at Bunker Hill, and there were some Jews at Valley Forge. So they did fighting and they did other things for the war effort. Jews who were strictly kosher during peacetime were forced to subsist on chocolate and coffee during the chaotic years of the war while they were in exile. In other words, if you're not going to eat pork, you're not going to eat glatt treif, what are you going to eat? If you really sincerely wanted to keep kosher, and you did in peacetime, but you just don't have much kosher food available to you, so chocolate and coffee is about all you got. You have a caffeine high. Samson Mears, originally from New York, took refuge in Norwalk, Connecticut. When Norwalk was destroyed in July of 1779, around the time of Tisha B'Av, he noted that the ongoing tragedies that befell the people continued during this cursed time of year, meaning that not just the Jewish people suffered during the 3 weeks, but even America, the new Israelites, are suffering Tisha B'Av, Shavuot, Sukkot, Tammuz. It's very fascinating that they're taking the Jewish tradition of tzaras, balai, you know, terrible tzaras during the 3 weeks and saying, oh, America also has tzaras during the 3 weeks. Okay. When peace broke out in the land in the spring of 1783, around Pesach time, it felt like a true moment of liberation. It was Zman Cherutenu. Okay, so if we're going to borrow from the liturgy, from the Siddur, and from the Jewish experience for the American experience, it was time to rejoice in a holiday of freedom. That Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of the unleavened bread, Pesach, the Zman Cherutenu, the Chag HaAviv, well, it's all happening when peace breaks out in the spring of 1783. Okay, so I mentioned that some Hessian soldiers, the mercenaries who were fighting for the British, stayed in certain colonial cities, including New York, and contributed to Jewish life. Well, they didn't go home when the war was over, because after all, Jewish life in Germany was not all that good, and Jews did not have equal rights. So it was better to stay in America. And having stayed, they were able to tip the balance in some communities away from Sephardic dominance towards Ashkenazic dominance. After all, they're Ashkenazic Jews. So here they fought for the wrong team in the War of Independence, but they stick around and they impact the fate of the Jewish communities. Okay. All the moving around during the war had an impact upon American Jewry. Many Americans who never previously encountered a Jew in their lives did so for the first time during the war. And what did they come to realize? That Jews aren't all that different from everybody else. This also would happen during World War II, when Jews would serve in the U.S. Army and be stationed in godforsaken places all over the South and the Midwest and everywhere, and American Gentiles from far-off places who had never met a Jew would do so for the first time, usually with a favorable result, because Jews don't have horns and we're not the devil. Okay, so Gentiles met Jews for the first time. Also, Jews from different communities found a home in exile in safe havens, and they met other Jews from other communities that they had never seen before, and they cemented relationships, including marriages. And so they had children, and now Jews from Savannah were meeting Jews from Newport, or Jews from New York were meeting Jews from Philadelphia. They had already been interacting because of commercial ties, but even Jews who had no commercial ties, who were not involved in mercantilism and trade, would see people they otherwise would never have met, and it led to increased shidduch possibilities. Okay. Certain communities did not do well in the end, and other communities were fabulously successful. So Newport and Savannah were decimated, and they really did not recover, at least not for a while. Savannah would have a strong Jewish community, including an Orthodox community, by the mid-1800s. But for a good while after the Revolutionary War, Savannah's community was badly damaged. Someone asked, how many Jews were Hessians fighting with the Germans? We don't know exactly, but probably at least 50, as far as I can gather. Maybe more than that. So So Savannah did not do well. Newport did not do well because the port was completely destroyed. Other communities did very well. So, for example, Philadelphia. Philadelphia became the central focus of Jewish life during the war and for a good number of years afterwards. And Charleston recovered and did well in the post-war era and had the strongest Jewish community of them all. Okay. The war changed the economic fortunes of many Jews, some for the better, others for the worst. Chaim Salomon did fabulously well during the war because of his linguistic skills and his talents in advertising and marketing. He did not do well in the post-war inflationary economy in which debts were not repaid. And I said he died impoverished. The war forced people to relax their religious scruples. Now, this is an interesting subtopic. During the war, even if you're a frum yid, what do you have to do? Right? Even the pious Jewish boy from Brooklyn who went to Torah Vadas in the 1920s and 30s, when he gets drafted into Uncle Sam's army and is fighting in the Pacific in 1942, 43, 44, is he going to eat scrupulously kosher, Chalav Yisrael, Pastyashan? No. He's going to eat treif. And if he doesn't eat treif, he's at least going to eat sardines and eggs. Okay? Or salmon, if he can get his hands on it. So we have to relax our religious scruples during wartime because we just don't have much of a choice. You have to survive. You don't want to die. Well, having done so, having relaxed your religious standards, people don't readily return to pious observance after the war ends. In other words, in 1783, it's similar to what would happen in 1945. The kid from Chaim Berlin in Torah Vadas, who goes off to the war and eats treif and isn't keeping Shabbos, when he comes back to Brooklyn in 1945, he's not the same yeshiva boy as when he left. And he goes off and to Long Island and establishes a conservative shul. So that's what happens. If people relax their standards in wartime, they remain relaxed even in the post-war period. Well, what happens next? So Sherith Israel has a problem on its hands. In the 1780s, it was basically empty. Not only because Jews in the post-war era were busy pursuing their economic interests and were too busy to go to shul on Shabbos because they were working and engaging in commerce because they don't want to have to take 2 days off Saturday and Sunday, but people also don't go to shul because they just don't want to go to shul. Okay, some people don't want to go to shul. All right, it's a sad reality of American Jewish life. Okay, every shul has that problem. You have people who disappear. You'll see if the Yom Tovim, maybe. All right, well, this is an ongoing problem in 1780s and 1790s American Jewish life. That the post-war economic opportunities demanded that Jews disregard their ritual laws, and they did so just because they didn't care. Okay, but American Jews remained proud Jews. Even if they weren't going to synagogue as often as they had been, and they were not as punctilious in their observance of the halachic minutia as they once had been, they were proud Jews, and they wanted their loyalty to America to be recognized by the general society and to be rewarded. Rewarded with what? With political rights. As opposed to just the economic rights they had previously during the colonial period, they want full emancipation, full citizenship, and political opportunity. So Jonas Phillips, the grandfather of Mordechai Emanuel Noah, appealed to the Federal Constitutional Convention in 1787 with the following statement. He wrote the following, quote, "The Jews have been true and faithful Whigs, and during the late contest with England, they have been foremost in aiding and assisting the states with their lives and fortunes. They have been supporting the cause, have bravely fought and bled for a liberty which they cannot yet enjoy." Whoa, strong statement. It's saying, we fought and died for this cause. We gave our treasure, our money for this cause. And remember, giving money to a cause and giving treasure to a cause may not seem nearly as important as bleeding and dying. But in colonial America, money was just as important as life. But this is, colonial America was an opportunity to get rich, to improve your material position, and to sacrifice your financial well-being was akin to sacrificing your very being. Okay, and he says, we did all this, but we cannot yet enjoy the full fruits of our labors. Now, many Protestants wanted Jews to satisfy themselves with their pre-revolutionary gains and no more. Meaning, Jews could be naturalized, participate in the economy, and worship freely. But they suffered from Sunday blue laws, from church taxes, from those states that had established churches, special oaths, and were denied political liberties. This halfway form of emancipation was considered reasonable enough for Protestants who thought that Jews still should labor under a divine curse. Meaning, if you have a theological point of view that the Jews are a damned people for being Christ killers or rejectors of Jesus, whatever it is, the Jews don't deserve full emancipation. They have whatever they have, and genug, must speak. Let them be satisfied with that, so say some of the Protestants. The Jews shouldn't push the envelope for full political rights. Protestant dissenters, such as the Baptists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians, wanted separation of church and state. And they appealed to religious liberty, absolute religious liberty. But they were happy with Protestant pluralism. In other words, let the Anglican Church get off its high horse and not, or the Congregationalist Church, wherever they're the boss, get off their high horse and allow for all the Protestant denominations to have equal rights. And that there should not be an established Protestant church, but rather all the Protestant denominations are on par with each other. However, only the Protestant denominations, and not the really radical dissenters like Jews, or for that matter, maybe Catholics. So they were not fighters for religious rights. Who then would fight for religious rights, for the expansion of the franchise, and for suffrage to people beyond the Protestant realm, to include then Jews, Catholics, Mohammedans, atheists, whatever other wacky denomination might exist? So who is going to fight for those people? The answer is those who are Enlightenment rationalists, who are thinkers, the likes of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and of New Rochelle fame, Thomas Paine, whose cottage is right around the corner from Young Israel. Okay, so some of these guys espoused deistic or Unitarian principles, but most importantly, they did not believe that Protestantism ought to have a monopoly over political rights, but rather it should be diffused across the board. So what ended up happening? New York guaranteed absolute religious equality for those born in America starting in 1777. They retained an anti-Catholic oath test for those born abroad. So if you were Catholic, you still had some disability if you were born outside the United States. But basically, other than that, New York said everybody's equal starting in 1777. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, wrote the Act for Religious Freedom in Virginia in 1785, which called for absolute separation of church and state, no religious test of any kind for the holding of public office or for voting rights. The federal constitution similarly created an absolute separation of political rights from confessional belief, okay? However, that's the federal constitution. That's not the states. And some states retained disability against dissenters and Jews and others even into the Republican period. In New England, in New Jersey, Maryland, and North Carolina, they continued with Protestant pluralism rather than full equality. But it was really absurd. Because if you think about it, it meant that in the year 1800, a Jew could run for president of the United States and win office. A Jew could become president of the United States of America, but he couldn't be elected dog catcher in Maryland. So here in Maryland is right flush against Washington, D.C. You can be president here and you can't be dog catcher there. It's ridiculous. So over the course of the next few years, all the various states would enact full religious equality and the political opportunity for despite confessional beliefs. Okay. But political equality does not equal social equality. Jews had to prove their patriotism. No single act of patriotism was enough to permanently prove the point. Not even fighting in the Revolutionary War. It's an ongoing, never-ending struggle to prove one's moral worth and one's civic loyalty in the face of centuries of accumulated prejudice. Meaning, people are inclined to think lowly of Jews, and to think lowly of Jewish loyalty, or to dismiss it altogether as being a bluff. And so you have to continually reinforce in the eyes of the heathens that, no, we are truly loyal to this country, and we're willing to make sacrifices to prove our loyalty to this land. Now, Jews tried to show their Americanness by participating as Jewish congregations, as houses of worship, in various celebratory occasions proclaimed by the government, whether days of prayer, days of fasting, Thanksgiving, or mourning. We don't do this much in America today. In the America of the 21st century, even the America of the late 20th century, I don't recall there being too many days when the government declares a Tanis Tzibur, or they declare a day of Thanksgiving. We have the annual one in November. You watch football and eat a turkey. But basically, in the olden days, in the late 18th century, early 19th century, it was quite common for the government, in a spiritual vein, to say this is a day when all the houses of worship, regardless of faith group, will offer Thanksgiving and fast or have mourning for some hero who died. Whatever it is, Jews participate in all those things as good patriotic Americans. They participated in the grand federal procession that took place in Philadelphia in 1788 to mark the ratification of the Constitution. Okay, the Constitution was signed in July of 1787 and was ratified by a sufficient number of states in September of 88, which was followed by the first elections in November of 88, followed by the inauguration of Congress in 1789, and the first U.S. President George Washington in April of 89. So at that grand ceremony, a march, the rabbi of Philadelphia, now he wasn't really a rabbi because he was just a chazan, there were no rabbis in America at that time, but he marched arm in arm with the Christian clergy, because after all, the Jews and the Protestants and the Catholics are all equal people, and so each group has its clergy, and they'll march as the board of clergymen, okay? But then when the rally was over, what happened? There was a big buffet dinner. But can the Jews eat from the buffet dinner? No, it's treif. So what happened? There was a special table with kosher food, with a little OU, you know, kosher food table, all right? So what do we see from here? That the Jews were showing their loyalty to the country at the same time as demonstrating that this country tolerates religious distinctiveness. So we can march in the parade and we can have our separate kosher table, and they're not a contradiction, but rather they go together, because this is the kind of country where you can be afforded that opportunity to have the kosher table. Okay. So we're part of a society, but entitled to preserve elements of our distinctiveness. Jews imitated the Protestants by organizing synagogues along democratic lines. This is an important point for the early Republican period. That in the olden days, the synagogues were not democracies. This is shul, not a democracy, I often say. Well, in pre-modern times, the Kehillah was not very democratic in structure. It was kind of autocratic in structure. And the synagogue could boss people around. It was not beholden to the desires of the rank and file membership. But that changed in early Republican America. The synagogues now drafted bylaws. Okay, the old bylaws used to be known as haskamot, the Hebrew word haskamot, or sort of agreements, bylaws. But they were not very democratic. For the first time in the 1780s and 90s now, synagogues draft constitutions. They call it a constitution. Just like America has a constitution, well, we're good Americans. Our house of worship will have a constitution. And it will not be a top-down situation where the president and the ma'amad, the junta, is able to boss people around, but rather the rank-and-file members will have rights. And some synagogues drafted a so-called Bill of Rights, that after the 1791 Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution, the first 10 amendments, so synagogues also had a Bill of Rights, where if you're a member, you're entitled to this, you can get a bar mitzvah, you get a plot in the cemetery, you get some kind of relief if you lose your job, all sorts of things that the Kehillah, the synagogue, does for an individual member was codified in a so-called Bill of Rights. Some shuls did this. And another important thing, to whom did American Jews turn for religious guidance if there was a question that was beyond the ability of the local chazan? To whom would they turn in the colonial period? To whom?
Rabbis in England.
Okay, good. So they would turn to the rabbi of the Bevismark's congregation in London. Well, after 1783, the tendency was no longer to look to London for religious guidance. Why? Because we have an axe to grind with England. You know, we're America. We fought a war against them. So the relationship between London Jewry and the Jewry of the New World is that relationship is frayed on account of the war and political differences that had emerged. Okay. So Shules would write a preamble to their constitution along the lines of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. So we, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, blah, blah, blah. So, for example, the community in Richmond, Congregation Beth Shalom, wrote as a preamble, we, the subscribers of the Israelite religion, resident in this place, desirous of promoting divine worship, dot, dot, dot. They purposely copied elements of the Constitution in drafting their own documents. Also, the Richmond community, which did very well for itself in the post-war era, invited all local Jews to join and pay dues. But notice they invited the Jews to join and pay dues. They did not try to impose taxes, force dues collection on random Jews who live in the neighborhood who have no interest in joining the shul. It's a voluntary principle, as opposed to what Sheriff Israel had done in colonial times, where if a Jew lived in Westchester or Long Island or Northern Jersey, anywhere within striking distance of Sheriff Israel, the synagogue would send them a dues notice, an invoice, saying, you owe us money because you're a Jew who lives near our synagogue and we are the Kehillah. Well, that Jew in Long Island or Westchester might never have had any interest in paying dues and might not want to be part of synagogue life. And so they didn't have to pay. But Sheriff Israel thought they could boss them around because that's the old pre-modern style of coerced membership, where the Jews are a corporate body. Sheriff Israel still tried to do this as late as 1805, but it failed. The voluntary model that which Richmond was adopting was the one that will win the day, because in America, nobody is coerced to join a confessional group.
That causes a religion. That causes a misunderstanding in Greece. Each each community, Jewish community, has within its members the obligation to pay what is known as a petza, a dues that all of them do. And the goyim think of this as being a way to circumvent paying taxes. I hear this and I confront them. I said, oh, the Jews don't pay taxes in Greece, you know. Ridiculous. They pay double. They pay the taxes, but they also support the Kehillah.
Yeah, correct. So, now, one other thing that happened as a result of the war and the democratic orientation of society is that the relaxed attitude of people towards religion was resulting in intermarriage. In the colonial period, intermarriage was really frowned upon. It happened, but it was frowned upon, and when you intermarried, you kind of were kicked out of the Jewish community. They were not tolerant of that kind of laxity, in Jewish identity. But after the war, when everything was becoming looser and more flexible, so the niceties of Jewish law were no longer much of a concern. The concern was you don't want to have a shanda for the goyim. And so, in these more democratic synagogues, conversions increased. Conversions to Judaism by the Gentile spouse. Historically, for historic and for halachic reasons, that had been largely frowned upon in the colonial period. Why? Because the Gentile spouse was not very likely to be a religious Jew. It was likely to be a conversion of convenience. And so we just didn't do these things. And also historically, Jews weren't allowed to do these things. But in post-1783 America, where there's really nothing to worry about, and people aren't all that frum, so this happened more and more and more, conversion for the sake of marriage. And also, just a tolerance to allow membership in the synagogue for people who made no effort to abide by religious strictures in their personal lives. As I said, an intermarried Jew, a Jew who profanes the Sabbath, a Jew who openly eats pork, all these things which might have cost you membership or resulted in sanction, financial penalty against you in an earlier period, were now kind of laughed off. As long as you want to be part of the Kehillah, we'll let you stay. Okay. Now, the Revolutionary War and the immediate post-revolutionary period were important steps in the process of Jewish equality in America. But there would be hiccups along the way, including a lot of missionizing of Jews during the Second Great Awakening between 1790 and 1840. And it was still a long, long way from the barely tolerated colonial religion of the 18th century to the situation in America of the mid-20th century, where Judaism is one of the three big religions, you know, Protestant, Catholic, Jew of Will Herberg in the 1950s. So Judaism is one of the three big American religions in mid-20th century life. We're not there yet in the 1790s. We're tolerated. Things are getting better. They're not perfect, but we're not there yet. So we'll stop here. And next time, we'll discuss Washington's letter to the Jews. I know that for those of you in Scarsdale, we did this a whole session on this about a year ago. And for those at Anshe Shalom also, we did this a year ago. But for the Woodmere guys and for everybody else listening at home, it's not available, I think, on YU Torah. So we'll spend a session on Washington's letter to the Jews and other topics related to the early colonial period. Okay, see you all next week. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
Great class.
Thank you.